Case number 13-7092, Dan Abraham Sephardi, an individual appellant versus Antigua and Barbuda, a foreign state et al. Mr. Rogers for the appellant, Ms. Errol for the appellees.
Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Rogers. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Dan Sephardi. Your honors, this case involves Dan Sephardi's attempt to collect on three notes and a related conditional guarantee from the government of Antigua and Barbuda and its agencies. The trial court erroneously entered summary judgment on statute of limitations grounds. We respectfully submit that issues of material fact exist and a trial should have been had on our equitable estoppel defense to the statute of limitations. We believe that there is evidence in the record, competent, substantial evidence in the record, demonstrating a factual dispute as to whether or not Mr. Sephardi was under duress, and I know that's not the particular factor, but was threatened, had his family's life put in jeopardy, had his father's freedom put in jeopardy, should he try to collect on these notes. Those types of situations, especially...
Once those threats disappeared, what was the time limit for him to file suit? 3 years or 6 years?
Your Honor, and that relates to the order that came out and first to address. In a vacuum, if we were starting from scratch, Your Honor, and interpreting the New York CPLR 208, in this particular instance, it would have been 3 years. However, that's not the way this case proceeded. And we believe that there was, in fact, a waiver of that. Because below, if you look at the motion that was granted, that motion that the defendants filed specifically said that Mr. Sephardi had that full six-year period.
So limitations period might be waived, but for purposes of equitable estoppel, would you agree that New York law requires due diligence once the impediment to filing has been removed?
Your Honor, yes. The New York law does require due diligence on behalf of the plaintiff in moving forward with their case after the actions of the defendants that warranted the estoppel have ceased. And so the critical issue is, when does the effect of those threats cease sufficiently for him to say, okay, now he needs to move forward and file the lawsuit? We respectfully...
There's a second issue, which is, after you determine when the threats cease, the second issue is, how long can you wait before there's no longer due diligence, right? That's the second issue. And then the New York case law say that the outer limit of what would be considered due diligence is whatever the statute of limitations, the relevant statute of limitations, would provide.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in this particular instance, we believe that Mr. Sephardi did exercise due diligence under the circumstances, and that he did file within the outside limit of the statute after the impediment to his filing ceased.
And you concede that the impediment ceased in 2006 at the latest. You're not arguing that the impediment ceased any time after that, right?
But, Your Honor, there's facts in the record that demonstrates that there are still impediments that exist. For example, if you look at paragraph 60 of the verified complaint, it talks about how in 2009 there was disparagement of Maurice Sephardi on the website of the ruling administration.
Right, but this is summary judgment, so just an allegation in the complaint isn't going to suffice. Did you have any evidence at the summary judgment stage to back that allegation in the complaint up?
Well, yes, Your Honor. First, it was a verified complaint where Mr. Sarfati attested that he was aware that his father was being disparaged by the current administration in 2009. We submitted that verified complaint in support of our opposition to the summary judgment.
That's it?
Sorry?
That's all you had?
That was for the 2009 incident. Right. That, okay. That is the only evidence that we have in the record on the 2009 incident.
When do you think the impediments lifted? Just so when do we start our due diligence inquiry from? What year?
Well, Your Honor, my personal opinion, if I were Mr. Sarfati, I probably still would not have filed suit. But let me take you through the steps of due diligence that he did undertake. But
right, so your view is that, in fact, I mean, really?
He overcame something that I could have never overcome, Your Honor,
right.
And I believe the finder of fact.
Right, as his counsel, not your personal view of when you might file a lawsuit. As his counsel, when, as a matter of law, do you think, law in fact in this case, it dissipated?
Your Honor, the last piece of evidence in the record is the 2009. So from that point forward, after that, we would submit that he would have the full statutory period after that. I mean, there's a number of instances leading up to that.
You think there were obstacles, sufficient obstacles under New York law to justify tolling until 2009?
Yeah, the second piece of evidence that we would point to in addition to the 2009, and the reason why I say I might, personally would not do it, and why Mr. Sarfati, as a matter of law, should have the right to argue this to the jury, is that the individual who, and this is taking a step back to the beginning of the story.
Let's be quick, there's no jury here. This is a bench trial.
A bench trial for the finder of fact at trial, correct, Your Honor, that if you go back to the beginning of the story when Mr. Sarfati's father had everything taken away from him and the threat started not to try to collect, there was an individual who coordinated that whole effort to place the Roy Dan company into receivership and strip those assets away from the Sarfati family. That individual, who was the attorney who orchestrated that, was Justin Simon, and he is currently, and from 2004 until now, the attorney general, and the ministry, and the director of the Ministry of Legal Affairs of the country. And so therefore, he's the one who has the power to carry out the threats that started in the 1980s and continued all the way through the 2000s, the filing of the complaint.
So what is your best case from, I assume you agree New York's the relevant jurisdiction to look to here. What is your best case from New York that shows that there was still sufficient threatening activity that we recognized under New York law as an obstacle to filing until 2009?
The best cases that we can point to in our brief, Your Honor, are the ones that talk about this being a case by case and circumstance by circumstance.
What case has the closest facts for you?
Well, of the New York cases, I don't believe any of the New York cases that we were able to find have the closest facts. The ones that have the closest facts are the two other United States Circuit Court of Appeal cases that we've cited, Your Honor, one from the Sixth Circuit, which I believe is the Chavez case, and then one from the 11th Circuit, the RCR. I might have gotten those reversed there. But the Sixth and the 11th Circuit cases, we believe, are the ones that are most analogous, and I understand those are not New York law, but we didn't find any New York law cases with these same facts. And those cases from the other circuit courts of appeal talk about circumstances where you have a threat emanating from a government, right, with the unlimited power and the extradition power to carry out the threats that they're placing, at the doorstep of this family, right? This family had all of their money and assets taken away from them. They were threatened such that Mr. Sarfati's father, Maurice Sarfati, had to escape the United States, travel to Europe, and then hide in Israel for almost a decade. And he had representatives of the government tracking him in each of those locations to threaten him there. And so under those types of circumstances, when you have a young man who I think was 6 years old at the time when his father came back from Antigua and said, "This is what happened. We've had everything taken away from us. Our lives are shattered." In that particular kind of circumstance, we believe that those threats are ingrained, those threats are real, they've carried out on their threats, and they keep threatening. And so in those instances, the Fear does not just let up when you have 6 months or a year of a no active threat, especially when there have been intervening years where there were no threats and then suddenly somebody pops out of nowhere and starts threatening you again.
So under that theory, how would one ever know when the tolling ends?
But in this particular instance, you would have to look to the circumstances of the case. You would have to subjectively analyze the individual who's testifying, concerning how did those threats affect you? Were you reasonably in fear? And those particular circumstances that if you filed this lawsuit, you would be in prison, that your father would be in prison. And to take that away from a fact finder and decide it at a matter of law without looking at the witness and judging that credibility.
I thought you said he could have kept saying that for years and years and years. He probably could have waited another 10 years.
Your Honor, and that's what trials are for, and that's what we have people judging the reasonability and the credibility of witnesses. Those should not be done based upon an affidavit or a deposition testimony. That's the way we believe this case should have been decided. The second issue, Your Honor, and I see that my time has expired, relates to the conditional guarantee. That's set forth in our papers, and I will, unless the court has any questions, I'll see
you.
Time.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
Conrad Errol here for the defendant, Pelley. I'd like to address some of the plaintiff's assertions regarding due diligence. This case was filed almost 20 years after the action accrued. And given the court's order of day before yesterday, looking at Section 2.
No, I thought you conceded that it didn't accrue as to this individual until 2000.
Well, we conceded, and I think the district court and both the plaintiff and defendant said he had 6 years to do the to file his action based upon the what we understood then was the New York statute of limitation for breaches of a contract on promissory note. So,
I'm just asking when it accrued. I thought you had conceded it didn't accrue until he attained the age of majority in 2000.
Well, looking at that, we said that even if then, if you measured it either by the 6 years or by the 3 years, as in Section 208, he would still have been out of court, or he still would have lost the summary judgment on this statute of limitation issue. Because what the court below found was that you have to be reasonable. Under New York law, you have to use due diligence in bringing your action after the threats are ceased. In this particular instance, the threats ceased in 2006. They could point to nothing that the government of Antigua did to prevent them from bringing their case. At this time, and at least as the record shows, in 2005, Mr. Safadi had sufficient presence to go to an attorney who told him to contact the government of Antigua to make a demand. We don't think it was a serious demand. It was simply a letter basically saying, well, do you remember me or something to that effect. In any event, that was 2005. If you use in the 2006 date as the statute of limitation, the outer limits of this period, then this was approximately 7 months before the statute expired, when he should have filed his action. He didn't. He waited for almost 5 more years to file his action. On that basis, Your Honor, I think that that's why the district court found this was an unreasonable length of time to wait to file his action. Therefore, he did not exercise due diligence.
What about the argument that was made that I think is different than what was in the briefing, that this person who was key in making the threats still has this very important position within the government, so in that sense, the threat still exists, and we shouldn't really use the 2005 or 2006 dates as when the threat.
Your Honor, I think if you are going to take the position that with successive changes of government, now the government of Antigua, you have a prime minister who runs the ruling party, and then you have the opposition. Sometimes the ruling party becomes the opposition. So if some of the members in opposition are still in the opposition that were formerly in the ruling party, they don't have much of a say in the governmental policies. So what the policy here is that you would have successive government, and as you correctly asked, how long does one have to wait before you file your lawsuit? Before that time, before it becomes, you know, people have died, memories fade, and all of that over these years. So you have 20 years from 1990 until 2010, when the action was actually filed. Your Honor, by any measure, that is an unreasonable amount of time for a person to wait to file an action that he knew that he had. Now, they could not find, there are no cases in the state of New York that would support the excessive amount of time that the plaintiff waited to file his action. There's none. The cases that may talk about threats are threats where you have serious human rights violations, such as I believe one case where the Salvadoran government, I'm not quite sure, but there were serious human rights violations where people were killed, and there the threat of being killed and actually killed, and people disappeared. Those were the kinds of things that would arguably extend a period of limitation where there is arguably a serious effort that you will be killed if you filed action. So I don't think that the plaintiff were able to carry the burden to show that the defendant should not avail themselves of the statute of limitation defense. And I believe that the district court was absolutely correct in stating that the plaintiff has not made out, as a matter of law, has not shown that the threats were so egregious that he couldn't file his action, that threats vanished in 2006, and that plaintiff cannot explain why it took him so long from 2005 to 2010 to file his action.
Can I ask on the conditional guarantee issue, does your client, which has the protections of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act here, object to disposition of that issue on, as the district court did, on Rule 59 grounds, rather than, you know, a lot of stuff has happened here without getting to your assertion, whether it's right or wrong, of FSIA immunity, interpreting that conditional guarantee, applying Rule 59, are those things the courts can do without first deciding your jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, there are several things that we think that's wrong with the so-called conditional guarantee, because one of the things that you note that the assignment, the guarantee was never assigned to anybody. And the guarantee, the language in the guarantee says that it is governed by the laws of Antigua and Barbuda. That's one issue. The other thing, the guarantee says clearly that it is good for 3 years.
Well, I think that means it's guaranteeing debts that come up within those 3 years. It's not a time limit for a guarantee.
But in any event, the enforcement of that guarantee, assuming even if you found that the guarantee is a conditional guarantee, as plaintiff would have you believe, that you'd have to go, at least from the plain reading of it, you'd have to go to Antigua to enforce it. And I'm not quite sure how that would work. How do you get the promissory notes have now been determined to be?
That's what I'm trying to ask you: would you even agree to a disposition? I mean, I think you agreed to having the first limitations and equitable tolling question decided before FSIA jurisdiction. Does your country object to having these other issues about the conditional guarantee decided without first? Because those get to be closer to the merits, one might argue, without your FSIA immunity being determined?
Well, my client has not told me that they basically object to the jurisdiction. Of course, that issue was not reached by the trial court, but they objected to the fact that they were sued here in the United States. And so they do not concede that this court had, that they had waived their sovereign immunity right. So I don't know, they have not told me that they would allow the conditional guarantee to be enforced. If you don't have any more questions on the conditional guarantee, I think on the plaintiff, that argument, Your Honor, that came about after the district court had rendered its decision in summary judgment. And even if the court had considered that conditional guarantee argument, I believe it was waived, it was too late, because they initially filed a Rule 60B motion, but because it was filed within the 28-day period, the court considered as a Rule 59E motion, a motion to reconsider. And having decided that, the court said, well, they were making basically arguments that they could have made prior to the action. For that reason, we ask that the trial court be affirmed.
Thank you. Give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of brief points. First, Your Honor's question, we believe that the immunity, foreign sovereign immunity, has been waived. It's explicitly stated in the notes that it's been waived in this particular instance, and we believe the commercial activity exception would apply there, so we think it's appropriate to get to these types of
But none of that's been adjudicated.
Correct, Your Honor. None of that has been adjudicated, and as far as we know, it's not been raised as an independent ground to affirm here, and so to the extent that this court reverses as we request, then that's obviously an issue that could be addressed below if the defendants choose to proceed with that motion.
And on your guarantee argument that the claim on the guarantee didn't accrue until essentially the district court granted summary judgment here, how do you reconcile that with your complaint, which at JA page 29 said the guarantee claims accrued in June 1990?
Your Honor, I did notice that as well, and to the extent that the court would have granted our Rule 59 motion, it would have been immediately followed by a motion to amend the complaint, because we believe that those allegations were basically incorrect, and that's not our current position. A couple of other points. First of all, we would just point the court to the joint appendix at 83 and 84, and that's where the defendants below specifically stated that the statute of limitations was 6 years after reaching the age of majority. So we believe that that issue has been waived. To Judge Wilkins' point about Justin Simon, the current Attorney General, we did discuss that point in our reply brief, Your Honor, in reply to some of the issues that was raised in the appellee's brief, and that is at page 6. And now getting to the core of the statute of limitations issue, we believe that there was it was unreasonable for Mr. Sarfati to come forward before he did, and the situations we would point to in addition to what we've already talked about would be the U.S. government Department of State memorandum in 2006, which noted that corruption remained on the island, and that would have only reinforced the fear. And I see my time is up, and so
thank you. Case is submitted. Thank you.